The hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Dan Novak, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Better technology and rising wages are leading an increase in sales of robots to big companies all across America. But smaller factories have shown less interest in the devices. Robots are costly purchases. Now, some investors are supporting a financial plan for a robot pay-by-use plan. This means smaller factories could pay to use a robot when they want its service, but they would not own the device. Gary Tan's business, Initialized Capital, is one of the investors. He says he sees three important social and economic changes taking place now. Tan said low-cost and better robot-computer vision and other intelligence technology is growing more available. He said financing is available at low interest rates also. And disagreements between the United States and China about supply chains have created more interest in robots, Tan said. The investor's business plan puts much of the financial demand on new robot companies. These companies carry the risk of a manufacturer losing a business deal or changing a product. Smaller factories often produce smaller amounts of special products that do not need robotic support. And Silicon Valley Robotics, an industry group supporting robot startups, says that in the past, financing has been difficult. Still, some powerful investors support the idea. Tiger Global, the biggest financer of this year's new tech companies, has invested in three robot leasing companies in 7 months. Bob Albert's family owns Polar Hardware Manufacturing, a 105-year-old factory in Chicago. The company paid less than $10 an hour for a robot. It paid the average human more than $20 an hour. Albert watched this month as a robot arm picked up a metal bar, spun around, and placed it in an older machine. Together, the machines created a door handle. "If the robot works really well, we'll use it a lot," said Albert, who was pleased with the early results. Westech Plastics Corporation, in Livermore, California, got its first robot in January 2020 and now has three from Rapid Robotics. The company charges $3,750 a month for a robot in the first year and $2,100 a month starting in year two. Melvin runs 24 hours a day, all three shifts, and that replaced three full operators, said President Tammy Barras about the named robot. She also said she is saving about $60,000 in labor costs a year with one robot alone. "We've had to increase our wages quite significantly this year because of what is going on in the world. And luckily, Melvin has not increased his pay rate. He doesn't ask for a raise." I'm John Russell.
Scientists say they have found a 43-million-year-old fossil of a whale ancestor in Egypt. The fossil remains help show how ancestors of modern whales might have moved from living on land to living in water. An Egyptian-led team of researchers made the discovery. The newly found whale belongs to the Protocetidae group. That is a group of ancient whale ancestors that might have lived on land and in the water. The fossil was found in the Fayum Depression in Egypt's western desert. The area was once covered by a sea. Scientists have made many discoveries there that have provided more information about the evolution of whales. The new species is named Phaeomycetus anubis. It is estimated to have been 3 meters long and weighed about 600 kilograms. It fed on other animals, the researchers said. It is the oldest whale ancestor known in Africa. Phaeomycetus anubis is a key new whale species and a critical discovery for Egyptian and African paleontology, said Abdullah Gohar of the Mansoura University Vertebrate Paleontology Center, or MUVP. He is the lead writer of a paper on the fossil. The whale evolution in Africa is still largely unknown, the researchers said. But work in the area can provide new information about the evolutionary change from amphibious to fully aquatic whales. Rocks in the Fayum Depression cover a 12-million-year period. Researchers have found semi-aquatic crocodile-like whales to giant fully aquatic whales, said Mohamed Sameh. He is with the Egyptian Environmental Affairs Agency and also a writer of the study. The research also raises questions about ancient environments. Part of the whale's name honors the Fayum Depression. The species name comes from Anubis, the ancient Egyptian god connected with the afterlife. I'm Dan Novak.
China has put in place a new policy that limits online video game playing for young people to 3 hours a week. The new rules restrict online gaming for those under age 18 to 1 hour in the evening on Fridays, weekends, and public holidays. The restrictions took effect on Wednesday. They were announced by China's National Press and Publication Administration, NPPA. That agency is responsible for regulating video games. The new rules place the responsibility for carrying out the policy on the gaming industry. The limits do not include punishments for individual gamers. China is the world's largest video gaming market. The Chinese government has worried for years about young people becoming addicted to games. Treatment centers have been set up in the country for people thought to have developed gaming disorders. In 2018, Chinese officials also expressed concerns that gaming might be causing rising rates of eyesight problems among young people. The NPPA said the new limits were issued to deal with a growing concern that online gaming was affecting the physical and mental health of children. Chinese state media reported that about 63% of Chinese minors play online games often, and about 13% of underage mobile game users are believed to play them for more than 2 hours a day on weekdays. Chinese technology company Tencent Holdings took the first step to restrict online gaming for young people in 2017. It limited playing time for some young users of its popular game Honor of Kings. The move came after concerns from parents and teachers that children were becoming addicted to the game. The first government restrictions followed in 2019. Those rules limited minors to 1 hour and a half of gaming time a day and 3 hours on weekends. The policy also limited the amount of money minors could spend on virtual items in gaming each month. The limit ranged from $28 to $57, depending on the age of the gamer. Current rules require minors to use their real names and national identification numbers when signing in to play. Gaming companies created systems to identify minors, but many young gamers found ways to avoid the requirement, such as signing in under the names of adult family members. The NPPA said online gaming companies will now have to prove they have effective identification systems in place. The number and intensity of inspections will also be increased to make sure they follow the new limits. The agency said it will also increase measures to punish gaming companies that violate the rules. Many young Chinese gamers criticized the new rules on social media. One gamer questioned whether officials understood the importance of gaming for young Chinese. This group of grandfathers and uncles who make these rules and regulations, "Have you ever played games?" the user asked on the Chinese messaging service Weibo. "Do you understand that the best age for esports players is in their teens?" Another gamer noted that the sexual consent age in China is 14 and that young people can start working at age 16. "But you have to be 18 to play games. This is really a joke." The social media comments were reported by Reuters. Some parents, however, told the news agency they support the new limits. Hotel manager Li Tong said he thinks the new policy will be a good thing for his 14-year-old daughter. "My daughter is glued to her phone after dinner every day for 1 to 2 hours, and it's difficult for me or her mother to stop her," Lee said. We told her it's bad for her eyes and it's a waste of her time, but she won't listen, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. James Madison of Virginia was elected President of the United States in 1808. He was inaugurated in Washington on March 4, 1809. The people of the city were happy with the new president, but the nation was not yet sure what kind of leader he would be. Madison's first 4 years were not easy. He had to deal with a foreign policy problem that the former president, Thomas Jefferson, was not able to solve: increasingly tense relations with Britain. Historian Alan Taylor has written several books on early American history and has won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. He says Madison took office under difficult circumstances.
Jefferson, in many ways, was a tough act to follow because he'd been extraordinarily popular. But he had made one great policy mistake with Madison's support. Madison had been his Secretary of State. And that mistake was something known as the embargo.
The embargo had arisen from a war between Britain and France. The two nations refused to honor America's neutrality. Each tried to prevent the United States from trading with the other. Both interfered with American shipping, and the British Navy sometimes seized American sailors. President Jefferson ordered a ban on trade with Europe, but the embargo failed to end the hostile acts against the United States. A month after Madison took office, the British minister in Washington, David Erskine, said Britain would stop seizing American ships if the United States would trade again with Britain. But Erskine did not make clear that the British government demanded several conditions. One condition was that the United States continue the ban against trade with France. Another was that Britain be permitted to capture American ships that violated the law. President Madison did not accept these conditions, but he still believed he had reached an agreement with the British minister. He announced that the United States would reopen trade with Britain. Hundreds of ships left American ports. But a few weeks later, Madison received surprising news. The British government had rejected the agreement he reached with Erskine. Letters were exchanged, but Madison could not get a good explanation for what had happened. He finally broke off all communications, and Erskine and his replacement left Washington. America's policy of trade with Britain and France continued to be a serious issue. President Madison approved trade with all countries in 1810. But when relations with Britain did not improve, he stopped trade with the country again in the spring of 1811. Trade was not the only problem, however. A growing number of Americans believed that the British were helping some Native Americans to fight the United States. As the people of the United States began to move to the northern and western territories, the government made treaties with the different Indian tribes. The treaties explained which land belonged to the Indians and which land could be settled by white people. The settlers did not always honor the treaties. Historian Alan Taylor explains that Indian tribes were trying to defend their homelands. He says they asked the British to provide them with guns and ammunition to fight against the American settlements.
And the British were playing a very ambivalent game. In other words, they wanted to keep the Indians on a kind of retainer in the eventuality that war did happen. They would want to mobilize those Indians. So they did provide them with guns and ammunition, but they hoped that the native peoples would just use them on the defensive.
A leader of the Shawnee Indian tribe, Tecumseh, decided to unite all Indians and help them defend against the settlers. Throughout the West, many Americans believed that the British in Canada were responsible for Tecumseh's efforts. They demanded war with Britain to destroy the power of the tribes. In Washington, a new Congress was meeting. Some of the new members were very different from the men who had controlled Congress before. They were less willing to compromise and more willing to defend America's interests. They soon got the name War Hawks. At the same time, America had a new Secretary of State. Madison chose his close friend, James Monroe. What the United States did not have at that troubled time was a representative in Britain. The British minister in Washington, Francis James Jackson, returned to London when Madison broke off communications. The American minister in London, William Pinckney, sailed home as well. There was no official in either capital to report what was happening. And in the spring of 1812, the United States and Britain were moving closer to war. President Madison had hoped for some sign of compromise, but he was sure there would be war. He had seen the instructions from London to Britain's new minister in Washington, Augustus Foster. The foreign minister warned Foster to say nothing about any compromise. He wanted the United States to see how firmly Britain would stand against neutral trade with its enemies. Also, historian Alan Taylor says the United States did not believe Britain would stop inspecting American ships and taking away any sailors the British thought were British subjects.
And because the British would not change that policy, and the United States was determined to try to force them to change that policy, that's why the war happened.
In the United States, Congress continued to prepare the nation for war. Lawmakers voted to increase the size of the army and to borrow money to pay for things the larger army would need. But not all lawmakers wanted war with Britain. Many Federalists especially opposed it. Congressman Hermanus Bleeker showed the House a list of hundreds of names from his area of New York. He said all these people opposed the embargo and the idea of war with Britain. It is impossible, he said, that we can go to war when the embargo ends 60 days from now. Where are our armies, our navy? Have we the money to fight a war? Why, it would be treason to go to war this soon, so poorly prepared. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin was having a difficult time finding money to borrow. He could get almost no money at all from Federalist bankers in the New England states in the Northeast. Congress had approved borrowing $11 million, but Gallatin found the banks would lend only $6 million to the federal government. The Federalists charged that Gallatin's difficulties showed that the people did not want war, especially the people of New England. If the people of the West and the South wanted to fight, then let them pay for the war. Yet, sure that Britain would not change its hostile policies, President Madison sent a secret message to Congress on June 1st, proposing that war be declared. Madison listed the reasons for war. British warships had violated the American flag at sea. The British Navy had seized and carried off persons protected by the flag. British warships also violated United States waters, interfering with American ships as they entered and left port. Another reason, he said, was Britain's orders against trade with France or allies of France. International law, he said, gave Britain no right to make such orders. Madison also spoke of the hostile Indians of the Northwest Territory and seemed to charge British Canada with helping the Indians. The president's message went to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives for discussion. The final vote in the House on declaring war was 79-4 and 49 against. In the Senate, the vote was closer, 19-4 and 13 against. President Madison signed the bill into law on June 18th. The War of 1812 had begun. The leaders in Washington did not know it, but 2 days earlier, Britain had ended its orders against neutral American trade. The orders might have been withdrawn earlier, except for a number of events. British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, under great political pressure, had decided to end the British orders on neutral trade. Businesses and traders were loudly protesting that the orders were destroying England's economy. On May 11th, before Perceval could act, he was shot to death. Not until June 8th was agreement reached on a new prime minister, Lord Liverpool. 8 days later, his government announced that the orders were ended immediately. This was only 2 days before war was to be declared in Washington, and with ships being the only method of communication, the British action was not learned of in time. If the United States had had a minister in London during the spring of 1812, the diplomat would have been able to report progress toward ending the orders. But the American minister, William Pinckney, had returned home a year earlier.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.